Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody. Sorry about that. Welcome back. This is Ali Milani back on Politics Uncensored. How you all have missed me. I am back with a new year and I would like to say a vibrancy, but I am currently dying live on air for all of you. I have allergies of some sort. I did a COVID test, not COVID. But I'm dying of some sort of allergies. So please forgive me if you hear this, me sniffling or dying live on air throughout this show. We've got an amazing show lined up in our first episode of 2024. And joining us, we've got journalist Ari Bolla from the Middle East Eye and Reem Ibrahim from the Institute of Economic Affairs. And what we're going to do later on is look ahead a little bit into 2024 and what sort of political predictions we can expect as this is the first show of the year. And we're all going to sort of nail our ideas to the mast and see how right we are by the end of the year in our political predictions. But before we get to that, we have the week unwrapped. And this is the part of the show where we talk about the issues of the day, some of the key stories in political and current affairs. And joining us for this is Natalie Balmain, winner of Channel 4's Make Me a Prime Minister, who has joined us a number of times previously. And it's a pleasure to have you, Natalie. How are you keeping?
I'm good. How are you, Ali? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Look, Natalie, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm dying. And I don't want to exaggerate or be that guy with man flu, but I'm not sure I'm going to make it to 6 p.m. So if this is the last time we speak, it's been an absolute pleasure.
I will make sure people remember you, Ali.
Thank you very much. Listen, are we going to talk about
New Year's resolutions?
New Year's resolutions, not die, survive the show, and not get deported to Rwanda would be a great show.
Yeah, let's
hope not. So, Natalie, before we talk about some of these issues, I'm going to ask you to do something for me. We'll go to a break halfway through this week's Unwrapped, and I want you to just think about one or two political predictions that you might have for 2024, because we're going to look back on these at the end of the year and see how right we've all been. But before we get to that, the key issue of the day, and really this week, has been Rwanda. The Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has urged the House of Lords to pass his flagship Rwanda policy as he warned peers not to frustrate the will of the people. Giving a press conference after the legislation was approved by MPs, Mr. Sunak said it was now up to the Lords to do the right thing. He's seen off a sort of mini Tory rebellion, and now it has gone to the House of Lords. I don't know if we've spoken about Rwanda together before, Natalie, but give me your thoughts about A, this policy now going to the House of Lords, B, what looks to me like Rishi Sunak essentially going all in as his political sort of gambit for the election being take back control of our borders and Rwanda.
It's absolutely hilarious, isn't it, that this is his sort of flagship policy that he wants to enter the election on? Because from what I can tell, you know, even the people who for this might be a priority, they're certainly not, he's not going to win an election on those numbers. And for the rest of us, we're all sat here going, frankly, we're just sick and tired of you wasting any more money on this. The fact that you're trying to push this through again, which doesn't just take away from the fact that, by the way, this is still considered an unsafe country by the Supreme Court. That ruling has not gone away. You know, the fact that they're trying to push this through already at a cost of over 240 million so far, which, you know, when you compare that to other funding pots, I know Jess Phillips yesterday very interestingly compared it to the pot of money that was put aside for support survivors of child and sexual abuse, which was a total of 4.5 million. You kind of go, what is your priority here? You know, there's a suggestion that this is going to cost close to £170,000 per person to deport them to. Does anyone in this country want, is it that much of a priority for anybody?
Well, I think it's a priority electorally for the Tories. I think from what I can see,
I'm not so sure about the voters.
From what I can see, it's the only thing that they have really that they can point to as something they want to do or will do. And I'm, you know, my gut tells me there's some sort of internal polling that tells them that if we run a really crude sort of divide and rule, anti-migration, close the borders sort of right-wing campaign, we might stop the bleeding for the election. Do you think that's all that it is? Or, you know, are they just a bunch of racists?
I'm sure that's what they believe. Whether that belief is founded in any sanity at all, I'm not sure. You know, to go back to the 240 million that they've already spent on this, that's already not worked twice. you know, that's equivalent to 5.7 million GP appointments. What do we think is more important to the
Yeah,
people?
of course, the leader of Rwanda has also said they'd be willing to refund the money, right? Give the money back if no planes actually take off. So,
Well, I hope that is the case, actually, in all honesty, because I think
but
that
they
they've
might
got
have
more.
just—I mean—they might have given the Tories an exit ramp out of this horrific policy, and they won't take it purely based on their own personal electoral goals, no?
Which would pretty much tell you everything about them, does it not?
It does, and let's talk about those opinion polls and the Tory the what looks like complete wipeout for the Tories if a new damning opinion poll is to be believed, which is predicting that the Tories are on track for a 1997 style general election wipeout. The research, which was commissioned by Tory donors working with arch-Brexiter David Frost, suggests that Conservatives are facing a humiliating defeat with several senior MPs that are set to lose their seats. The YouGov survey of 14,000 people suggests the Tories could retain as few as 169 seats, while Labour would sweep into power with 385, giving Sir Keir Starmer a massive 120-seat majority. Do you believe this poll?
Absolutely. I don't think it takes a G. I don't think they needed a poll, did they? I think they could have just gone around and done a vox pop in the street.
The thing is, I think if they went out onto the streets, they'd have things thrown at them. That's the problem.
Well, this is true. You know, it's incredible, isn't it? You know, every time the Tories come to Manchester, I live in Manchester, every time they come up here for their party conference, you know, the Mancunians are chasing them down the street, and
Think I
it's
saw another video of Rishi getting booed in the street. Look, I want to talk about this, but I'm a little bit skeptical, and I'll tell you why. I'm skeptical not because I don't think this is where the country is. I do think this is where the country is, and I think the country's desperately, you know, wants to get rid of the Conservative Party, and I really don't think there is anything they could do at this stage to overturn, because generally what people will look at, and I think in some ways Biden has this problem in America, generally people will look at, am I better off or worse off since these lot were given the reins of power? And it's undeniable that people are worse off now than they were 14 years ago. And so I think, you know, they're toast in that sense. What makes me skeptical is we've had some electoral reform, we've had some boundary changes, obviously, around the country, which has reduced the number of MPs, particularly in the nations, and has increased them in England. And what we're looking at is a boundary review that largely benefits the Conservatives. And I say that because if the same votes were to happen in 2019 under the new boundaries, the Tories would have had an extra, I think, 15 to 20 MPs. And Labour would need a swing of about 13 to 14% their way just to get a small majority, let alone a big majority. And this is the problem. I mean, we can have a whole conversation about the problem with our, you know, first past the post system. But I mean, a 13 to 14% swing Labour's way, I think it's actually 12.9 officially, to get a majority of one. That is a huge swing. It's larger than 1997 was. And in 1997, bear in mind, the opinion polls had Labour on 50% leading up to the election. So, do you think we need to take this with a little bit of a grain of salt? Because I've got into far, maybe that I've got into far too many elections thinking we're going to win and then disappointed afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously it does sting when you understand some of these things that are going on, but I do believe that voters, and especially young voters, are as switched on as they've ever been. And you know, the
Do you
amount
think they'll come
of
out and vote?
I do, and the amount that I'm hearing young people talking about tactical voting, it's actually incredible. And I do think that perhaps maybe, you know, for all the changes that the Tories want to try and make and save themselves, they may have underestimated young voters somewhat.
So that could really be the blowback at the general election, is that people are voting who wouldn't have otherwise voted because they are just so angry at where we are in the country. Okay, and I wonder if one of your political predictions could be what you think that general election would look like. But before we go to that break, when you can come up with what your one or two is, let's look at what has been a really, really painful, I think, story around the post office scandal. The UK business minister Kemi Badenoch has written to Fujitsu to demand talks on how much it would pay towards compensating Post Office Horizon victims after the scandal wiped out more than $1 billion off its value. The share slumped following testimony from one of its senior executives on Tuesday, who told MPs the Japanese technology company had a moral obligation to contribute to any redress for the hundreds of post office operators who were wrongfully prosecuted on the basis of its faulty IT systems. For those who aren't aware of the story, really do go look into it. ITV has done a brilliant dramatization of this scandal, and this was where post office operators around the country were prosecuted on the idea that they had stolen money, and it all turned out to be a faulty IT system. Some of them served jail time, many of their lives were ruined, their reputations were ruined, and it's one of the most shocking scandals, I think, coming out of this country in decades. Natalie, what do you make of what this whole scandal we've seen unfold over the last couple of weeks?
I mean, there's an interesting thing that I want to pick up on the quote from, I think it's from Kemi or from the government there, which is that they say that that Fujitsu have a moral obligation. Stuff the moral obligation for one second. They've got a legal obligation, have they not? They provided a product that was not fit for purpose. Now, you know, under the Consumer Rights Act of 2015, or, you know, for things that were purchased before October 2015, the Sale of Goods Act of 1979, the law states that any goods you buy must be of satisfactory quality, fit for any particular purpose made known to the seller, and as described. I mean, I'd argue that the Horizon system was none of those things.
Natalie coming in with the receipts, I love it.
Why are they not just being hauled up in court? Why are we demanding talks with them? No talks are required. You've broken your contract.
Yeah, it's I think it seems to be that everybody is sort of trying to dodge some level of responsibility here.
Yeah, no accountability once again.
And this story hit the airways not a little while ago, but it really took, I think, the dramatization of ITV to bring this to fore and to explain to people exactly the level of scandal and tragedy that has gone on here. After the admission of Fujitsu, Bandung wrote to Fujitsu Group Chief Executive Takahito Tokita, demanding urgent discussions on the proportion of the compensation the firm would have to pay, according to a report by Sky News, which has seen part of the letter. Fujitsu is one thing, but how much responsibility should government take for redressing this horror? Because people's lives were ruined.
There has to be an inquiry, and I'll tell you the reason why there has to be an inquiry. Because at the time that Fujitsu were in the procurement process with the UK government, they were also in a similar procurement process with the Department of Defence. Now, the Department of Defence rejected the Horizon system.
I wonder why.
Because they discovered that it wasn't fit for purpose. And there's arguments to say that information was passed on to the government here or certain advisors here as well, and they decided to go ahead with it. So absolutely, there needs to be some accountability here.
Yeah, and I think Ed Davey specifically is picking up quite a lot of heat as a result of...
It's very easy. We've got a Tory government at the moment. Blame, you know, the one Lib Dem guy who was involved in it. There have been 12 or more Tory people in this post since then who've also done absolutely nothing. Yeah. So let's not forget those as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always up for that. So listen, the theme of the show... I love that you've come with receipts today, by the way. The theme of the show today is going to be predictions. This is the first episode that we're airing post 2024, and I want you to have a quick think over the next break about one or two political predictions that Natalie will make that I'm going to hold you to and bring you back at the end of the year and see how, by the way, I'm also going to do that this later on with guests. Okay. So let's see how we all do, but think about one or two and maybe a wild one while we listen to these messages.
FUBAR Radio presents
All areas.
And we are joined now by our lovely guest, James Johnson, celebrity hairdresser. How are you, James?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
What was Mel B like then? I used to be a Spice Boy.
The best energy.
Did you sing to her?
I can't sing.
Nor can I, but I still
don't. I remember the job got cancelled. I went to wherever she was staying in London, it got cancelled. And whoever she was living with made us Victoria sponge cake. So the job got cancelled, we all sat around the table eating cake. I got in the car and I was like, I've just sat with a Spice Girl eating Victoria sponge.
Oh, noshing a bit of Vicky Sponge.
Nick Helm and the Nathaniel Metcalfe's fan club.
We are joined in the studio now by professional comedian Brett Goldstein. How are you doing, Brett?
I'm very grateful to be here with you two.
If you could dig someone up and fuck them.
Gene Kelly.
Gene Kelly and Cary Grant, right?
Not Cary, there's not much time. If I could dig up Gene Kelly, I'd say, could we do a dance?
I've got the shovel in my boot.
In this scenario, is he still dead when you dig him up, or does he come out?
Does he come to life? Is he a rotten corpse, or is he...
That's fan club!
The Dating Show. Dating, or going on dates when you were, like, a teenager was always quite fun, though. Do you know what I mean? I remember going on dates to, like, the cinema, or you'd go shopping, like, shopping centres, wouldn't you?
I think, if anything, they were, maybe this just says about life and where it is, but I used to get really excited, like more excited than I do now. Like the thought of going to meet someone in a park, a boy, it was like, oh my fucking God, what trainers am I going to wear? Are my trainers clean? Am I going to plait my hair? It was like, if the thought that would go through my head just to meet one person, whereas now, you know, you might meet someone on the way home from work and it's like the effort, you're still making an effort, but it's like, yeah, I can fit you in. It's completely different.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani on our first edition of Politics Uncensored here on FUBAR Radio in 2024. I really hope everybody's had a good Christmas, New Year, holiday break over the last couple of weeks, although most of us have been back to work, I think, for at least a little while now. I've got Natalie Balmain here with me, winner of Channel 4's Make Me a Prime Minister. We've just gone through this week's Unwrapped, and the theme of the show today is we're going to be looking at some political predictions going into 2024, and I've put Natalie on the spot over the break and asked her to come up with a few. Natalie, let's go with the first one. What's your first political prediction of 2024?
Okay, so I already mentioned this briefly before, but I think similar to when Biden won in his first election in America, we're going to see record numbers of people coming out to vote in the general election this year and record numbers of young people. I absolutely believe that. I look forward to it. I hope I'm right.
So we're going to see a huge bump, you think, particularly in young people. And yes. Do you think there's one or two specific, I mean, is it the cost of living crisis? What's behind your thinking around this?
I actually don't think the cost of living crisis is the biggest driver for the young people. They've lived in this for their whole lives. You know, they're quite sturdy when it comes to the cost of living crisis. What I think it is it's a moral obligation. I think that our young people are aware that our government are making decisions without our, you know, even taking them to Parliament, for example, you know, to seek approval from Parliament, let alone from anybody else. They're elevating themselves above the law. And I think that young people can see the way that this is going for them and for their future, that it's heading towards totalitarianism and they don't like it.
You know what I think is amazing? I think it's, you know, it's easy for us to forget, but there are 18-year-olds who'll have the right to vote in this coming election that will have only really known a Conservative government. Because they will have been four, I think, or something, when the election happened and the Tories came in. So there's a whole generation of people that are going to be voting this time who have only ever known Conservative governments. Do you think that might...
And they have hope, and that's the beauty of young people. They still have hope. They've not been driven cynical by decades and decades in the system. So, you know, I'd love to see it.
And I don't know if this is part of your predictions. What result do you think we're going to get at that general election, looking at it now? Obviously, we're still far away. Campaign hasn't happened, but...
I believe Labour are going to storm it, just because I think that for the most people, they're the realistic other option. I do think we're going to see huge, huge increases for the Green Party. I think young people are going to vote for the Green Party. I'd love to see that for them. I think they're going to do really well. The one thing that I don't think anyone is going to challenge me on is that it's going to be a very, very sorry day for the Conservatives.
Do you think Rishi will still be the candidate for Prime Minister?
I think so, because I think they're aware now, after everything that happened during 2022.
They couldn't surely go for another one, could they? I mean, a poll did come out today that showed that the Tories are at their lowest place since Liz Truss was ousted from office. I think they're 27.
I know, I do hear that letters have been going into the 1922 committee about Rishi too. So, you know, they're back at the old game.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, 27 points behind Labour is what YouGov is saying.
I just think that they haven't got it in them to run another leadership race before a general election, and I don't think they'd risk it.
Right. And do you have any other ones? Do you have another political position?
Yeah. So I'd like to talk for a second about South Africa's case against Israel.
Of course, that's the case in the International Court of Justice that South Africa's taken on Israel following the assault on Gaza.
I think that perhaps this is going to escalate and snowball the case itself, not just the horrific situation in Gaza and Palestine. I think that perhaps other countries might get on board with South Africa's case. And I think that the case might extend to the people who are essentially funding Israel, which could potentially be, well, it will be the US and potentially us included.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to note the implication that this could have. We're obviously signatories to the International Court of Justice, and the permanent members of the UN each get a judge or so on it. And as you've said, other countries are joining in. So Slovenia have said that they're going to be joining in on the that they may potentially look at joining the case. So you think this could have a snowballing effect? What sort of impact do you think it could have here in the UK?
Well, I mean, essentially, we could find that our current government will be, you know, hauled up in court because they are supporting, funding and enabling a huge breach of international law. And you know, that we are helping to facilitate war crimes, not least the very visible dropping of white phosphorus, which is completely illegal in any scenario, anywhere in the world, in any situation. So,
yeah, and I think we're going to be covering that a little bit later on as well. as I think we've now got over 25,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza. Most of Gaza has been devastated, and I think 85% of the population in Gaza have been displaced, and 1 in 100 people have been killed since the beginning of the assault on Gaza.
What the courts will look at there, as well as the tactics used, not just the numbers.
Yeah, of course.
And when you look at it in terms of the tactics, in terms of the places that they've bombed, making escape routes available and then bombing those.
Yeah. And then also the quotes from senior Israeli officials as well, who
it's a really, really strong case against Israel.
Well, those are two very, very interesting predictions. I'm really interested, particularly in the outcome of this ICJ case, as well as whether we are going to get record numbers of voters in the next general election. Natalie, so thank you so much for joining us. Tell people where they can find you, what you're up to.
I am up to all sorts as usual. I'm still out here doing a lot of work in the field of diabetes fundraising and awareness. But you can catch me and my journeys on Twitter at Real Miss Balmain or on Instagram at Miss Balmain.
There we go. Do give her a follow. She'll continue to hold all these receipts and come for the Tories in the lead up to the general election. I'm sure we'll have you back on, Natalie. That was Natalie Balmain, winner of Channel 4's Make Me a Prime Minister, joining us on this week's Unwrapped. Next, we're going to be going full-fledged into political predictions. I'm probably continuing to talk a little bit about Rwanda and this case in the ICJ. And I will be joined by Reem Ibrahim from the Institute of Economic Affairs and Areeb Ullah, journalist at the Middle East Eye. They will both be joining me for the duration of the show after this.
Hey! FUBAR Radio presents
Access All Areas.
Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Oh, yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going through your head when you thought, I'm going to shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running round.
Except you wouldn't be 80 years old. No. You'd be
26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored. Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing "Oh Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience and I was very pleased we did it. The office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
Every
yeah.
single one said yeah. it's really necessary yeah. for them to yeah. come.
The Dating Show.
I'm friends with a fair few exes and I think you can be friends with an ex, but I genuinely do. But I do think that it's timing is everything with that.
I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you talking about someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like if you've already shagged, isn't that a bit weird?
I think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level of friend. You can be friends with someone, you can't be like best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff. But I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to FUBAR
Radio. FUBAR
Radio.
FUBAR
Radio.
FUBAR
Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani on the first episode in 2024 of Politics Uncensored. We've just been speaking to Natalie Balmain, the winner of Channel 4's Make Me a Prime Minister, around some of the key issues
facing the country and some of the key headlines coming out of our politics. We spoke about Rwanda. We've spoken about the ICJ case that South Africa has brought against Israel. We've spoken about post office and many other things. First of all, it's remarkable. It's 25 minutes past and I'm alive and I'm still here, which it really is amazing given how ill I feel. Both my wife and my sister today told me I'm exaggerating, but I think the producers can attest to the fact that I'm one foot in the grave right now. But we continue, and I'm very excited to be joined by my next set of guests as we look ahead into the politics of 2024. Joining us in the studio is Areeb Ullah, journalist at the Middle East Eye. Areeb, thank you so much for joining us. And Reem Ibrahim from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Reem, if I can first come to you, how are you keeping? I love the setup. It's so professional. You look better than I do in that and in this HD setup.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we've just renovated our studio at the IEA, so it's great to have new cameras, new mics.
Looks brilliant. And I've been following some of your travels on socials as well, so you have to tell me about that probably off air though. Areeb, how are you keeping?
I'm all right.
Yeah,
blisteringly cold, but here I am.
It's
blisteringly cold. It is
very
cold.
It is very cold. You obviously have been keeping up, particularly with what's going on in Gaza and some of the tragic scenes that we're seeing. Yeah. We're now 100 days deep into this assault. Yeah. Do you want to give people? We just spoke with Natalie about the ICJ case South Africa has brought up. Where are we at in terms of an overview of 100 days after the initial assault in Gaza? Where are we at now?
I mean, I could sum it up in two words: death and destruction, pure and simple. I think when I last saw the civilian death toll, it's beyond 24,000 Palestinians who've been killed in Gaza by Israeli forces. It's very difficult to kind of tell. I mean, in terms of my personal situation, in terms of what the work that we're doing at Middle East Eye, we're worried about our colleagues who are stranded in Gaza. We're worried whether or not they're going to be alive tomorrow. We're worried about whether or not they're going to have enough internet to keep reporting the really important story that's taking place there. I think one sense I get from my colleagues in Gaza especially is the sense of hopelessness, you know, the sense of should we keep on doing this, you know?
Yeah.
And when I speak to my colleagues like Maha, for example, I mean, the simple answer I give is, listen, if you need to flee with your family, go, you know, because it really is a situation of life and death at the minute for them in Gaza.
Can I just ask you quickly, the reports that we're getting is now 1 in 100 people in Gaza have been killed. 85% of people have been displaced.
Yeah.
And the images that we're getting is just horror. Mm. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this, at least in our lifetimes.
Mm.
But it's not just Gaza where the issues have come out. I want to talk a little bit about the West Bank as well, if we can. I mean, the reports I've got here is 360 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in the last 100 days.
Yeah.
Over 6,000 people have been arrested, and the UN numbers are horrific. I've got a story here from someone called Ahed Amir, who said that 2 days ago, Israeli regime's forces invaded a Palestinian town in the West Bank to take down South African flags that had been put up by residents. Ahed went up to a rooftop to see what was going on. There she was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper as she was trying to look at what was happening. So, I mean, a lot of the focus has rightly been on what's going on in death and destruction in Gaza. And often the response from Israeli spokespeople.
What we're seeing in the West Bank especially, we're seeing a massive political crackdown on Palestinians who live there. And I mean, the justification that the Israeli government have given, for example, its military campaign in Gaza is it's trying to eradicate Hamas. Now, the fact of the matter is the presence of Hamas isn't as strong, if not existent, within the West Bank, you know?
I mean, almost completely non-existent in the West Bank,
To a certain degree. I mean, there's no denying that Hamas does exist in the West Bank, but at the same time, it's not to the level that it is in Gaza. Yeah. So the justification that they're giving.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to bring up the West Bank, because what I've seen in terms of Israeli spokespeople around the British media specifically has been, whenever we talk about it, whether it's bombing of schools or hospitals or anything, it's always Hamas is under there somehow, or Hamas is involved in human shields and Hamas. The problem is, you can't use that same argument with 360 people killed in the West Bank.
The thing is, snipering people
on rooftops.
One thing I think is important to note is that the political climate in the West Bank has been deteriorating pre-October 7th. And by that, I mean, we've seen my colleagues, for example, Lubna Masaro, who's the bureau chief there, she's reporting to us weekly attacks of settlers attacking Palestinian villagers, for example, who are tending to their farms.
Yeah. With immunity from the...
With protection at some times as well by the Israeli forces. You know, so I think the situation in the West Bank has been often overlooked for a long time. And now what's happening in Gaza is sadly now shedding light to what's happening in the West Bank. Yeah. And what we're also seeing is that the settler community in the West Bank are becoming more emboldened. And that's leading to the deaths of Palestinians, sadly, in the West Bank.
Yeah. Reem, I'm going to bring you in, but not on Gaza, because we've spoken about Gaza and ICJ a lot today. But we've also spoken about the Rwanda policy. And I know you've spoken a lot, specifically on social media, surrounding the Rwanda policy. We've now got the Prime Minister who has today urged the House of Lords to pass the flagship Rwanda policy. He's asked peers not to frustrate the will of the people. Can you give us your sense and your sort of view on this policy and where we might go in the next couple of weeks?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, it's been really interesting to see the way in which it's been used somewhat like a political football. I think that especially post Suella Braverman's resignation as Home Secretary, and we've seen the huge amounts of political turmoil around the Rwanda policy. Let's be clear here. I mean, for the Conservative government, all they need is a photograph of one or two illegal migrants on a plane, and that's the political capital for them that they need.
Yeah.
So it's not even, I don't think, necessarily about whether or not they're actually able to get thousands of illegal migrants onto planes in Rwanda, on their way to Rwanda. What they actually want is the sort of political capital that it gives them.
Yeah.
We also need to think about the huge cost of the Rwanda policy. It's already costed about £240 million, and that's taxpayer money that's going towards this this scheme that actually hasn't let any illegal migrants actually go to Rwanda yet. There's obviously, of course, the ethical arguments around it. And, you know, there are a couple amendments that were voted on last night as well. There was the Jenrick Amendment, which effectively was there to try and make the Rwanda bill as watertight as possible. It basically meant that people... It would be more difficult for people to try and appeal being shipped off to Rwanda. And I think it's within the broader conversation about what do we do about illegal immigration. It is incredibly high. But is the solution safe legal routes so that economic migrants can more easily come to this country? Is it the demonization of illegal migrants? And is that the key problem here? Or is it really a vote winner? Is this all about the Conservative government trying to win?
That's what I want to ask you about, because that's what me and Natalie were speaking about. Because I don't, you know, I think anybody can say that the policy so far hasn't been successful. We spent £240 million taxpayer money. Not a single plane has taken off. Not a single migrant has landed in Rwanda. Is this just an election gambit?
I personally do think that it is, but again, this is more so about the way in which the policy hasn't been effective. Rishi Sunak and the government overall has been able to shift blame elsewhere. We saw today the Prime Minister with his quite bizarre press conference. I don't know if any of you saw the sort of things that he was saying, but he effectively said the House of Lords better not block this, or the House of Lords better not.
You know what I noticed? In that press conference, I noticed, I think the term take back control of our borders, and I suspect that that's going to be the election tagline that the Tories are going to run with. Do you? So let's assume, I mean, it's part of my predictions when we go into our predictions in a second. Let's say a plane does take off, or a couple of planes do take off, and they're able. Do you think it will work at all in shifting what is, I mean, YouGov is suggesting 27 point difference between Tories and Labour. Do you think it'll shift public opinion at all?
I think it really depends on what happens with the economy. I think that's the primary, the most important issue in this country for many, many people. The cost of living crisis, I mean, as we all know, has been incredibly difficult, and inflation has been soaring. We've seen it come down very recently. My colleague Julian Jessop has done some fantastic analysis on the inflation figures and actually said that, you know, that now is really the time for the government to start looking at supply side reforms. But when it comes to immigration itself, I think the Conservative government seem to think that it is the number one issue for most people. That the primary reason why immigration is used as a scapegoat is because people feel poorer, and immigrants are very easy, especially illegal migrants, are very easy to push the blame to. But we know, I mean, the evidence is clear. Migrants in this country actually provide the treasury with significantly more money than native Brits do. So
it's also I suspect it'll be hard for the Tories, and it might sound like a party political attack. It's not really. I suspect it's going to be really hard for the Tories to stand on the economy come the next general election. I mean, things might shift by November, which is when we think we're going to get it, but I'm not sure any Tory would want to stand on look at what we've done with the economy at the general election.
Absolutely. I mean, it really is kind of a farce, right? The Conservative Party is supposed to be the party of the economy. Yeah. And yet we have the highest tax burden since the Second World War. We've seen soaring inflation. We've seen huge amounts of red tape and regulation that have meant that, for example, we've not been able to build enough homes. There have been multiple government targets. Let's think back to Rishi Sunak's five promises, one of which, again, was NHS reform, stop the small boats, cutting inflation, and all of those things, those predictions. Inflation potentially has come down, but again, it wasn't necessarily.
Well, it's shifted back up again. I think it's now at 4% after a period of rapid decline. But that's really interesting. I want to go now to our political predictions, and that's the sort of theme of the show. And I've got people from different perspectives here, hopefully. And we're going to be looking forward at 2024 and then maybe making fools out of ourselves come the end of the year, given our predictions. But that's more likely to be me than anyone else, so that's okay. I've asked each of our guests to prepare a bunch of political predictions for 2024 and what we might see. Reem, given that you've just been on, do you want to give your first political prediction of 2024?
Yeah, so my first prediction is that at the March budget, we are going to see a whole load of tax cuts. I suspect we're going to see something particularly similar to what the Liz Truss administration attempted to do, which is primarily supply-side tax cuts, supply-side reforms. Specifically, I think the inheritance tax is going to be scrapped. The reason why I think that's...
Scrapped in its entirety?
Yes, I think inheritance tax could be scrapped entirely. And the reason why I think that is because it doesn't raise the Treasury a lot of money. So it actually isn't that important to the Exchequer. But what it does do is it gives it has this political capital. It has this gravitas of a Conservative government that is here to slash taxes and, you know, encourage families to grow and encourage investment. Again, I mean, you know how much I love tax cuts. I actually don't think inheritance tax is the priority. It's not necessarily going to...
I do know how much you love tax cuts, by the way. We once sat in a green room and within 3 seconds of meeting each other, you were talking about tax cuts. So I know it keeps you up at night.
It does. I am a bit of a nerd for tax cuts.
But I'm going to ask about the politics of this, because obviously the tax cuts that Liz Truss brought in was largely seen as the reason behind her downfall and the economic crash. Do you not think there'll be some jitters within Number 10 about whether that strategy will work again?
Yeah, so I think the primary problem, and again, I mean, even looking back at the Conservative Party leadership election, it feels like ages ago, but it was only a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, with the leadership election. Those are two very, we were presented with two very different definitions of what conservatism means. So I think the Conservative Party itself is sort of going through a bit of an identity crisis.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Doesn't really know what it stands for. Yeah. You had Liz Truss, who effectively argued for small government and some supply side reforms. But then again, the primary reason I think for her downfall was that actually at the same time as promising all of these tax cuts, they were unfunded. And then she also promised huge amounts of spending for the energy price guarantee.
Look, by the way, I think you're spot on in terms of the identity crisis of the Conservatives. And no matter what you think of Keir Starmer, I don't think there is as much confusion in the Labour Party. Yeah. That he has taken complete control of the Labour Party, whereas in the Conservative Party, you know, you've got the sort of right wing, the Kemi Badenochs of this world, the Suella Bravermans of this world, and equally you've got David Cameron and the sort of more One Nation Conservatives, if you believe that term, coming in. You've got Libertarians, you've got all sorts of different factions battling it out within the Tories. So that'll be interesting ahead of the general election. Areeb, I'm going to come to you. By the way, feel free to jump in here. Areeb, your first political prediction.
Going to be a weird one, but I think more primary schools are going to close down in London.
In London? Tell us why.
And by that, I mean, in the last year, we've seen primary schools close down in Camden, in Hackney, in various inner city London areas, because simply put, people can't afford to live in the city of London anymore. And
You think numbers are going down in terms of the need in London because people are moving
out? And also because I think... people are thinking twice about whether or not they want to raise a child in...
To have kids at all. I mean, we do have an ageing population in the UK.
But also, I think when it comes to cost of living and everything else, people are second guessing themselves and thinking twice about the idea of even going down that route.
Yeah.
You know?
Are you ditching London?
I might
potentially.
Be. Potentially. Yeah. And it's very hard to say that because I've lived in London my whole life.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're all, let's call us all a bit young or young on the youngish side. Reem, you're definitely young. The two of us are the ones with the grey hairs. But, you know, I assume you live in London. Have you thought twice about living in London, given the costs and the expense? I mean, I definitely have.
Absolutely. I mean, I've considered moving abroad, where actually outside of the United Kingdom, you can get for what
Well, if someone looks at your Instagram, it certainly looks like you did move abroad over the last couple of months.
Are you thinking the Middle East, where no taxes are?
Well, not necessarily the Middle East, because it's still quite expensive. But I mean, I've just spent a month in Southeast Asia, and what I spend in rent in London, I could get a pretty swanky mansion. So,
but I think it's really interesting that we've got three here people who are under the age of 40, relatively young in the economy, who are working, who also don't think that London is affordable.
I love how you said not under the age of 30.
It was dangerous. I didn't want to ask people ages, but we've all considered London almost unaffordable to live in, right?
Yeah,
I think it's completely unaffordable. But I also think what's interesting, I mean, I'm assuming all of us have grown up in London, right? Mm. We've seen what it's like. And I mean, I think that going, so I grew up in Northwest London in Ruislip. And
represent.
It's, I did. I campaigned against you.
Yeah, you didn't vote for me. Where can I mute this microphone? Which one of these numbers? Yeah. See, for all the critics, by the way, all the random comments I get under this show, by the way, I've got someone here who campaigned against me. That's how open we are to different views. I'm going to go to my political prediction now, and I want you guys to react to it. I think the general election will happen this year before December, and I think Labour will get a majority, but I think it will be a razor-thin majority. I think it'll be less than 20. And I think I described that a little bit earlier. But look, the polling suggests, given the new boundaries, that Labour would need something like a 13-14% swing to get a majority of any kind, and to get a huge majority, we're talking about probably 15% swing. That's much higher than they got in 1997. And so my view is I think Labour will win a majority in the next general election, but I actually think it's going to be quite small. What do you think?
I agree with that. I think one of my predictions was Labour will win the next election, but in tandem they'll also lose their vote within Muslim communities here in the UK.
Talk to us a little bit about that, because obviously that's a huge issue given the positions that they've taken, some of the comments made around Gaza, specifically in Palestine. Yeah. And, you know, there have been polls coming out, and I think
we're going to see a number of areas with Muslim majority considering less to vote for the Labour Party, and purely on the basis of how they voted on a ceasefire vote.
Yeah, I think, look, it's important to say 4 million Muslims in the UK, but they're quite often highly concentrated in specific areas. So we're talking about London, East and West, Leicester, Birmingham, Bradford, these sort of areas.
I mean, the reason why I'm saying this, in terms of some of the reporting that I've done in terms of the British Muslim community here in relation to Palestine, is that for a lot of Muslim voters that I've spoken to, they've said to me that they feel that Labour has neglected them. They feel that Labour has taken them for granted. And some would have even considered the Conservative Party, but when Rishi Sunak completely backed Israel over the last few months, for them it's like, I'm all right.
Well, a recent Savanta poll did show that Labour have dropped into the 60s with Muslim voters. And let's bear in mind, in 2019, it was 83% of Muslim voters supported Labour. Now it's in the 60s, and it's probably even lower because that poll was done before the ceasefire vote. Reem, I just want to get your views on Labour majority. What kind of numbers do you think, or do you think Labour might not win?
No, I do think Labour will win. I think it all depends, and this is one of my political predictions, on whether or not Nigel Farage joins the Reform Party.
You know what? It's on one of mine. So let's go into that prediction. Tell me about that prediction.
Yes, well, it kind of relates back to whether or not we get a Labour majority and how big it is, right? Because ultimately what will happen is if Nigel Farage joins the Labour Party, joins the Reform Party.
They're all so similar, we don't know which one he's going to join.
They are all the same to a libertarian. But if Nigel Farage does join the Reform Party again, and he does get back into Reform Party politics, and Reform do pick up more of those Conservative votes, then I do think that the Conservative Party is completely finished and there will be a much larger Labour majority. if that's not the case, and actually if Nigel Farage doesn't join the Reform Party, if Reform don't do as well as they are predicted to do at the moment, then I suspect that it will be a razor-thin majority for the Labour Party. But I do think the Labour Party will win.
But we need a prediction here. Do you think Nigel will join the Reform Party and stand against the Tories or no?
I think he will. This is my prediction. I think Nigel Farage will join the Reform Party. I don't think he'd ever join the Conservative Party. I don't think the Conservative Party would have him. But I do think there is a wider political realignment where the Conservative Party are pushing out people like me who predominantly believe in a small state and I'm a libertarian across the board. And
yeah, I mean, it's no longer about tax cuts with the Tories, is it? It's just about planes to Rwanda.
It's about the culture war. About the culture war, and it's about immigration, and it's about trans people.
Yeah.
And it's no longer, and you know, it's no longer about having a strong and stable economy. I do also think, though, I just want to come back to the point that you made about Muslim voters and the Labour Party. So my family are very devout Muslim, and they have, you know, they've sort of, my dad's a bit of a swing voter, my mum's side have always voted Labour, but this issue has got them interested in politics like no other issue has. Yeah. They've always been very bored by any of my media appearances, very, very bored by politics itself, and very apathetic, actually. Yeah. Mm. Israel-Palestine is the single issue that mobilizes Arab and Muslim voters.
And they're mad at Labour or everyone?
Mad at everyone. Mad at the West, mad at governments, mad at Rishi Sunak.
And that's going to carry through into the voting booth, you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can't see any of my family members voting for either the Conservative Party or the Labour Party. They will vote for a party that will call for a ceasefire.
You know, on this point, obviously the Muslim vote is very diverse. It's not as homogenous. It's not this one single block. But, I mean, just talking in general terms, I do think when I speak to Muslim voters in Birmingham and Bradford, those places that you mentioned, who've been traditionally Labour, I think they have more spite towards what Keir Starmer has been saying the last few months than what Rishi Sunak has been saying.
Yeah, because I think there's a different level of expectation.
Exactly. And on top of that, like, for a lot of like Muslim voters, they're also from a working class background. And for a lot of them, historically, they viewed Labour being their political home.
Yeah.
And now I think a lot of them are like, well, we've had Corbyn, who was the complete opposite of what Keir Starmer is doing. What's the point?
And so I mean, similar to Reem's family, right? You said your mum voted Labour, presumably in 2019 she voted Labour in Ruislip.
I have no idea what she voted in 2019, but she
I'm trying
up.
To get out that she voted for me, Reem. Come on, like,
your mum voted
shout out
me.
Mum Reem.
She would have probably, I'm not sure how she voted, to be honest,
probably,
but I'm sure
Ali
she would
was
have
like, yep.
absolutely there we go. Loved someone. Well, especially because of your views on Israel-Palestine, I mean, she would have definitely supported you over Boris Johnson.
There we go.
That gives me my ego boost
for the week, don't worry.
The ego boost. I do think Israel-Palestine is a more, especially the call for the ceasefire, is like the predominant political issue.
I think one of the main things we were seeing, I saw it in Luton specifically, was this idea of a vote for a vote. Don't vote for the ceasefire, you lose our votes. Right, we're going to go into my next prediction. We're going to have to be quick because we are running out of time. My next prediction was that I think that Donald Trump will beat Joe Biden. I think they'll both be on the ballot. And I think Donald Trump will beat Joe Biden at the next presidential election in November in America. What do we think? Ari, welcome to you first.
Well, he's not even the nominee yet, so we don't even know. It might be
he'll early. Beat him from prison even, I think, at this point.
I mean, the polls are saying that Trump is definitely up ahead of Biden. And
yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if Biden remembers he's even there.
Yeah. Well, look, I think one of the that's funny. One of the reasons that I think I've put this as one of my predictions is in all of the battleground states, Biden is now trailing Trump. And I know it's we're quite a way away from the general election, but it's not that far away. And I think the difference is going to be, I think, you know, Trump's base will vote for him and Biden's base will vote for him. And I don't think that will change. The key question for American voters is these sort of independent voters in key states, places like Pennsylvania, places like Florida, places like Ohio, for example. And I think they'll be looking, and Reem, you've kind of spoken about this old Reagan thing of it's the economy, stupid. I think they'll be looking at whether they're better off now under Biden than they were the last day that Trump left office. And I think, you know, COVID aside, I think they'll be looking at the economy probably pre-COVID under Trump and thinking we might have been better off back then. Whether it's true or not, it's the feeling of the economy.
I think people have forgotten about COVID. as horrible as it sounds, yeah. I think for that, for a lot of people, it's a fever dream. It's like, it's done now.
But I think they'll be looking back on that period and going, you know, I don't think I'm better off under Biden. Reem, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And we saw with the new primaries in New Hampshire and in Iowa, where effectively, I mean, looking at the way in which the battle has gone down, I mean, very similar to the Conservative Party's battle in the UK for ideology, there is an element of that. The Republican Party is undergoing, I mean, Hallie's a little bit more of a, I suppose, libertarian, a little bit more, I mean, I think her economic plan, she called it the Freedom Plan. So again, advocating for tax cuts, primarily talking about the economy, and also saying that Trump is just like Biden. He is old, he is a member of the establishment, he is not somebody that we want to be representing us on the world stage. He focuses a lot on foreign policy, yeah. Which I think will bode well with a lot of Republicans.
You seem to doubt whether he might be the nominee. Do you think he'll be the nominee come November?
I do think he will be the nominee, but I don't think it's set in stone yet. It'll depend on whether or not he ends up in prison before the election.
Yeah, and so if I was to ask you now, you know, I think, what is it, November 16th? When's the election? November 15th? I forget. Who's going to be the next president of the United States? Is Joe Biden going to be the next president?
No, I would suspect it would be Donald Trump. That is a prediction of mine. I do think Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States. I do also think there is a risk that that he could be in prison before then, but he could also govern from prison.
Prison, funnily enough, he can. Yeah, he can win the presidency. Arib, I didn't ask you, who do you think is going to be the next president? Is that one of your predictions or no?
No.
Okay, so let's go into your next prediction.
Steered away from US politics.
Give us your next prediction, because I actually have a Middle Eastern one, which is obviously the field that you work in. So
I think Israel will reoccupy Gaza.
What does it say here? Israel reoccupies Gaza. Yeah, so that was my prediction as well. I think up until now, it's been a siege, and the military occupation over the last 100 days has been slightly separate. But everything that we're hearing out of Gaza is that Israel will take full command.
I honestly think before the ICJ case, I think Israel's plan was initially to push the Palestinians to live in Gaza all the way to the Sinai, even if the Egyptians wanted it or not. But then when I think the ICJ case was starting to pick up some pace, and you saw a lot of smaller countries joining in with South Africa as well over the last week or so, it's definitely been a PR disaster for the Israelis. And I think,
and when you mean reoccupy, tell us what you mean.
By reoccupy in the sense that I believe...
Similar to the West Bank?
Similar to the West Bank, whereby it will become the occupying power.
Feet on the ground, soldiers in Gaza.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Reem, we're running out of time, so I just want to get one more prediction from you. We've asked you all to do some wild card predictions, so that's what we're going to end on. But one more, let's call it normal prediction from you, and then we'll go to the wild cards.
So, okay, I mean, I think it's particularly interesting is the way in which the UK have kind of focused around Brexit. And so my regular political prediction is I think that we're going to try and foster new trade deals and actually make the most of Brexit. I mean, I think that Brexit was a pretty positive thing. I think that taking control and being able to foster new trade deals rather than being forced to into trade deals within the European Union and being forced to be regulated in that way is, I think it was a pretty good thing that we left, but we have not, we've taken back control, but we've done bad things after taking back control.
Maybe we didn't do very well with control. We give it back.
Well, that is true. That is true. It's effectively like saying, okay, yes, fine. We've taken away control from a supranational institution, the European Union, but then we've then put that power back.
Do you think that trade deal could be with the EU as well or outside the EU?
I think I would like to see, we've got a trade deal with the EU, and I think we'd like to see more trade with other countries outside of Europe. I think an American trade deal could be on the cards if Trump is president.
Yeah, of course, because Biden himself has kind of put that on the back burner. He himself has said that might not be possible. I think he did that in his Ireland trip. So with Trump winning, it's certainly probably more likely that we get it. Right, we're approaching the last couple of minutes, so we're going to do the wild card ones. I'll go first. It's a wild card one. Okay, so let's not take me too seriously here. But I don't think it's outside the possibilities. And I'll explain why. I think it's possible that Nigel Farage, within 2024, joins the Conservative Party. And the reason I think that is I suspect if the election happens in, let's say, November, and Labour win, I think the Conservative Party will go through a period of a couple of weeks or months. Maybe it pushes into early 2025, but that the Conservative Party has this identity crisis and comes out with someone like Suella Braverman at the helm. It might not be Suella herself, but someone on that side of the faction. And as part of their sort of rebrand into what I'll call the extreme right of politics, embracing Nigel Farage in that could be an electoral gambit, a political gambit, a PR gambit to kind of rebrand the Tories as Donald Trump's sort of style, right-wing populist party. How crazy is that, Reema? I'm going to come to you. Oh, you're about to...
You make that sound so reasonable.
Yeah, well, I think it's possible. It's unlikely, but it's possible.
And based on what we've seen by the Conservative Party of the last, like, few years...
I mean, if you'd told me 5 years ago that Lee Anderson would be the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, 30p Lee, who, by the way, remarkably yesterday said he didn't vote on the Rwanda bill because he walked into the no chamber and Labour MPs were sniggering at him, so he left because he couldn't vote because they were laughing at him. What kind of a... But this is on GB News. Go and check it out. That is an adult human politician with the letters MP following his name who didn't vote a certain way because people were laughing at him in the chamber. How crazy is Farage joining the Conservative Party, Reem?
I don't think it's that crazy. I don't think it'll happen because I don't think the Conservative Party will want him. I also think Nigel Farage, his kind of a unique selling point, if you will, his USP, is that he is part of the establishment, but he pretends not to be. And he pretends to be this kind of anti-establishment figure. So I don't think he will want to join the Conservative Party because he will ruin that USP and it will completely
But he's wanted a seat forever. You don't think a promise of a constituency or a safe Tory seat will do it for him?
I don't think that's what he wants. I don't think he wants to be an elected politician. I think he wants to control them and he wants to cause a stir. And that's what he has been doing. He's very successful at it. And I think that ultimately, you know, he's had his stint in elected politics in the European Union. He was always sort of a one-issue politician. And I think, again, this kind of comes back to this idea that we need to make Brexit a success. I think Nigel's primary issue is going to be that. It's going to be about taking back control of our borders through immigration and through restricting immigration, restricting illegal immigration, but also about still being an anti-establishment figure. And he's criticised the Conservative Party relentlessly because he feels as though that they are part of the establishment, even though Nigel is also part of the establishment.
Right, Reem, going to your wildcard prediction.
I think smoking is going to be banned altogether. And the reason why I think that is we have the tobacco and vapes bill, which people seem to have forgotten about it very recently. But it's attempting to go through Parliament, where the government have said anybody after 40, anybody born after 2009 will not be legally allowed to buy tobacco products. Now, whatever your view on this, I mean, I think it's a crazy invasion of liberty. Whatever your view on that, I think in 10 years' time, when we're having this conversation about what will happen in 10 years' time, and a 25-year-old will be legally allowed to buy tobacco products, but a 24-year-old will not be legally allowed to buy tobacco products, everyone's going to say, well, this is just crazy. We should ban it altogether.
Oh, so you're talking about not this bill coming to full fruition, where over a period of decades that you essentially ban it, but it will just come in as a sort of the bridge will come down and go, this is ridiculous. We'll ban it altogether.
Yeah, well, this bill effectively says that anybody born after 2009 will not ever be legally allowed to buy it. Yeah. So what will happen in a few years' time, and I think actually the conversations will start this year, people will say, well, hold on a minute. Is this really allowed? And I think also there's an element of discrimination law where are we being ageist here by allowing certain ages buy products and certain ages not buy products? And people are going to say, well, this is ridiculous. Ban it altogether.
Yeah, and... obviously, for a libertarian like you, this is horrendous. Very I won't bad, go into it because then you'll call me an authoritarian lefty. And my next question was going to be, what's wrong with getting everyone to stop smoking? But I don't want to be called an authoritarian lefty. So, Areeb, we'll go to you quickly. What's your wildcard?
Your producer didn't tell me I had to be a political one.
No, so. It's okay. Go for current affairs, social. Just don't tell me about Love Island and we'll be all right.
I think Tottenham will win a cup.
All right, we've got to mute his microphone because this is absolutely ridiculous.
I'm very confident. I'm very optimistic.
Tell me why Tottenham will win a cup. I'm okay with football chatting.
I don't know. I just have a hope.
You have a hope. Yeah. I've got to tell you. So
it's the same as
you know, my wife is a Tottenham fan. And so I have come into more contact with Tottenham fans recently than I should, really, as a United fan. But I've never seen a Tottenham fan with hope before in my life. So this is interesting. Which one do you think it is? Which one?
Potentially the FA Cup.
The FA Cup, which you're still... Because you're not still in the Carabao Cup.
No, we're not.
No, so it's just the Premier League, the FA Cup.
I think that's it.
And that's it. So so it's the FA Cup, really, that you're going to really want to win. Well, listen, thank you both so much for joining us. I've had Reem Ibrahim from the Institute of Economic Affairs joining us via Zoom, and Areeb Ullah, journalist at the Middle East Eye. Thank you for joining me in the studio as we've looked at some of our political predictions. We're going to look back on this at the end of the year or whenever the general election hopefully hits us and see where we are given these predictions. We've had everything from, I think we all agree that Labour is going to win some sort of majority, whether that's razor thin or whether that's a thumping majority, according to Ream, depends on a little bit around reform. I think we generally agree that Trump will beat Biden. Israel reoccupies Gaza was one. Smoking would be banned was a wild card shout. My wild card shout was that Nigel Farage would join the Conservative Party. And it wasn't smoking that was the wildest of shouts. It wasn't Nigel Farage that was the wildest of shouts, but it was Tottenham Hotspurs winning a cup that was the wildest of shouts that you heard here on Politics Uncensored. Thank you all for listening to us for our first episode of 2024. You can follow us on FUBAR Radio at Politics Uncensored. I am Ali Milani at Ali Milani UK. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and I now have TikTok. I'm with the kids, so please go and check those out. You can go back and listen to all of our episodes from 2023 as well on all your podcast platform, whether that's Apple or Spotify or Android. So do go check out our past episodes. We've had everyone from Jeremy Corbyn to Lord Heseltine and everyone in between on the show over the past 2023. We're looking forward to having you in 2024. I've been Ali Milani. This has been Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.